It's a great pleasure to be here at this Willem Mathesius lecture series. I love Prague. Every time I come, I like it even more. It's a beautiful city. So if I have an opportunity to come and actually do linguistics and computational linguistics, then all the better. I want to, by the way, I'll let us out at 12:55 so that we don't have any time constraint getting to lunch. What I want to address, I hope this is legible. Can you see this in the back? Yeah. There are several themes. Unfortunately, all the red has been washed out in this lecture. And in particular, I'd like to look at some fairly fundamental issues of the theory of compositionality as practiced in theoretical and computational linguistics. The goal here will be complementary to the lecture that Martha gave this morning, and I think will continue being complementary to her lecture tomorrow when we continue again on Thursday and Friday. So let me just tell you what I'm going to try to do in this lecture today. My assumptions here that are not at all radical, but I want to make it clear what is entailed by making these assumptions, is that language meaning is constructed compositionally. And I want to explore today, what does that mean? What does it really mean to be compositional? All right, I'm not going to just adopt that as a mantra and then go on my way and do some statistical induction or classification or do some theoretical analysis and representation. I want to really get our hands dirty and discover what does it mean for us to make an assumption that the model we create for our data is compositional. The second assumption, and this will be a theme throughout the lectures, is that semantic theory constructs models over artificial data. As semanticists or linguists in general, we start with an artificial body of data, call it the lab data. But the fact is, and this is why I'm a computational linguist as well, is that compositionality must account for corpus data. When we take our theory and then try to have it run over or analyze real data, the types of data that Martha was alluding to earlier in her lecture, I want to call that taking the model and putting it in vivo, as a biologist would say. So we have the lab, sort of the artificial situation or environment for my theory, call it, you know, the thought experiments, and then we have the in vivo. Corpus data must be annotated with existing theories, however. We have a theory, we're trying to do annotation, and I have to take something as a starting point from which I do annotation to then do automatic acquisition, learn a rule base, and then do some sort of performance over, have a system perform well over a body of data so that I actually have an application that works, be it machine translation, question answering, or just accounting for data in a theoretical way. But the thing is that corpus phenomena force revisions and enrichments of the theory. And so what I'm going to do today is I'm going to question compositionality. I'm going to look a little bit at how generative lexicon is a theory of selection. And selection is the primary element in compositionality. Thursday, we're going to look at how things blow up when we actually go to data. But we're going to try to keep the reins of corpus data somewhat contained. We're going to try to contain it somewhat. So the corpus data, and we're going to look at what kind of semantic transformations are actually going on to explain these corpus data. We're going to look at pattern analysis over corpora. We're going to look at clustering and induction over lexical sets and arguments, some statistical, rule-based statistical work that we've been doing. And then Friday, we're going to try to marry the two. We're going to try to take the existing model of compositionality and see how these corpus data force us to enrich it and extend that theory. So today, I'm looking at the methodology of what empirically driven semantics is. I think empirically driven semantics is the only way to do semantics as a linguist now. I want to define compositionality, as I mentioned, and then we're going to look at how composition needs to be enriched, the notion of compositionality, what Jackendoff and I have called enriched composition. So, and this is in order to explain more of the data. So, I hope this is readable. The role of annotation in linguistic theory is something that cannot be ignored or taken lightly. Semantic annotation, and I don't know how many of you are familiar with annotation schemata. How many people here have done annotation over a corpus or over a small set of data, training data, or just for, raise your hands, please. Yep. Is this, say, dependency tree bank or part of speech? What kind of annotation have people done? Just yell it out. Dependencies? Functional? Yep. Anything else? Part of speech? Ontology based? Okay. Semantic roles? Anaphora? All right. Okay. So, many of you, most of you are actually not familiar with it, at least from actually doing it. Semantic annotation is critical for robust language understanding. I think that's a given. But let's figure out and understand why. Because those of you who haven't done it, you don't care because you haven't really gotten your hands dirty. Annotation schemata, so this is a methodology, all right? Annotation is important for having a corpus annotated with whatever, some annotation. I'm not going to tell you what it is yet. Why do you want an annotated corpus? You want an annotated corpus that you know is right. It is the correct assignment. That correct assignment in this corpus can be used for training a system, a rule-based or statistical machine learning-based system, in order to then go to new data to perform and to do something, all right? This is, in fact, very much like the in vivo extension of our Gedanken experiments as linguists. We think of some sentences that our theory will cover, be it morphology or morphosyntax or phonology or syntax or semantics, and we think, do I cover all the data? Let's see, there's this bizarre aspectual stuff going on in Slavic. Does my tense aspects theory account for all that stuff? Well, you have to have the data and you see if it goes. You go to those data, and for as many of the data sets as you can become familiar with, you apply, extend, reapply, modify your theory to those. It's exactly the same thing going on in the annotation cycle. And I'll show you how. Annotation schemata, just as in linguistics, the best annotation schemata should focus on a single coherent theme. So different linguistic phenomena should be annotated separately over the same corpus. So Martha is working on annotating verbs and their argument labels with verb senses disambiguated. Prop bank with verb net. I'm doing events and time expressions. I need to integrate those because events are essentially the predicates that prop bank has annotated. Massimo is annotating anaphora, anaphoric relations. Those anaphoric relations are the entities that are the participants of the events, which are the arguments to the verbs, and so on and so forth. So, but the fact is, it's important to keep the annotation scheme separate so that the annotation itself is simpler to perform, the quality of the annotation is higher, it's more correct, there's never complete correctness, it's more correct, the rules, or the rule-based systems or the machine-based, machine learning-based systems that you can apply to them will perform better, and so on and so forth. You actually then have validated this annotation. So annotations have to be consistent with each other. They must live together. I can't have an event annotation that is completely inconsistent with the way verbs are annotated in PropBank. So we have to get together and figure out how to do light verb constructions or support verb constructions or lassen or laisser and faire and fare in other languages. I need to have some way of making the PropBank annotation of those consistent with what I call an event in TimeBank or TimeML, my annotation effort. Okay. I hope I'm not beating a dead horse here. I think this is really critical. So what we call this is the annotate, train, test model. And the annotate, train, and test model, it really does advance linguistic theory. We take a theory. The theories need testing to evaluate the coverage and predictive force. And the thing is, we're at a point now in linguistic theory, in the linguistic sciences, we could call it, where the semantics, I think syntax generally is pretty well understood, to a point that in fact, it really doesn't matter what theoretical language you adopt. You could take minimalist, you could take HPSG, you could take minimally recursive semantics as a model for HPSG, you could take LFG, you could take dependency tree structures, you could take combinatorial categorical grammar, you could take role and reference grammar. It doesn't really matter because they're interchangeable. They're interchangeable not because one is more important than the other or less important. We've reached an understanding of the phenomena. And that's good. That's actually a normative element in syntactic understanding of language. That's what we want. What they differ on are mappings. Mappings to semantics, mappings to argument realizations. So Van Valen's theory is very different than LFG and their glue semantics, which is very different than the Levine and Rappaport theory of argument realization, which are all different from Jackendoff's proposal in his Faculty of Language. Okay, but what this just indicates is that semantic models are too complex to develop without the strategy of annotate, train, and test. So let's give some examples of semantic annotation and just get familiar with what I'm talking about and what I'm doing. You can annotate predicators and their named arguments. This is like PropBank, for example, in a way, but in fact, not exactly because, well, let's just say that it is. So you have the man painted the wall. You can have anaphores and their antecedents, such as the protein inhibits growth in yeast. I want to know that these guys, which are in blue, hopefully you can see the color, are coreferent. I need an annotation that tells me they're coreferent. This doesn't say it, I've left it out. You need, even for things like acronyms or abbreviations and their long forms, so in the biomedical domain, this is a very, really big problem. So PDGF is in fact the short form for a long noun phrase, noun compound, platelet-derived growth factor, so on and so forth. You might want to do stricter ontology-based semantic typing. The man fired the gun. I may actually want to annotate the verb fire for disambiguation purposes as selecting a firearm and a human in the subject, so as to distinguish from firing someone from a job. So as in Trump, you're fired, you know, that kind of fire. So the typing on the predicate disambiguates the predicate. Well, in these two examples, the first one and the last one, what's going on is I have selectional information from the verb is actually encoding the compositional structure. So you can't talk about selection without invoking some notion of compositionality. That's what I'm gonna just make this clear, all right? So everything that Martha was talking about is assuming a particular kind of model of compositionality. Here, we're gonna kind of go into that assumption and say, well, what happens if you make this assumption? And what's the trade-offs? So here I can say that a verb is selecting an agent and a patient, and that's some annotation that would be part of the lexical entry of paint. So it would be a template, for example, or let's say a schema or a pattern that would be very similar to other agent-patient verbs, and with all the incumbent syntactic consequences, as you're familiar with and as Martha was talking about. Or you may want to have a more specifically typed argument for the internal role, the internal direct object, namely that you're doing something to a surface so that paint isn't going to apply to a mass of something, okay? And also to somehow give you the idea that you're affecting the surface of an object and not its internal constitution or something. Now, this is just one example. Similarly, you can make the very specific choice of fire or the very general choice. Well, what does this have to do with compositionality? This is what it has to do. We are assuming, when you do annotation, you assume an annotation scheme, okay? So if you're doing intonation, you're doing speech, you're doing part of speech, tagging, chunking, whatever it might be, all the way up to ontology tagging for the semantic web, for subsequent clustering, or for the kind of stuff that we're talking about within these series of lectures, namely anaphora, semantic role labeling, et cetera, et cetera. You need a scheme, okay? Now, that annotation scheme really critically assumes a given feature set. You got to have a feature set. You can't annotate if you don't have the features. And if you don't have an annotatable set of features, you're not going to get good annotation. And what's the point? Okay? So the feature set encodes the specific structural descriptions and properties of the input data. In other words, what you're doing, you're taking these really quite elaborate structural descriptions, and you're essentially flattening them and just turning them into features. That's not bad. That's good. You want to be able to do that. But see, these structural descriptions are actually derived from decades of linguistic theory, of research. The structural description that you have for creating tree banks, for example, or for dependencies, is the culminating result, product, of 30 to 60 years of linguistic research. And that has to be admitted. But not just admitted because, you know, you'd like to give some credit to Jakobson and all those other guys who are all dead. No, the point is that it's part of the cycle. It's a methodology. That these theoretically informed attributes derive from empirical observations over the data. And here's the catch. So what I've done is I've worked backwards this chain. The annotation relied on features which were derived or distilled from a description, a structural description, which assumes some type of theory. Very often, the relationship from theory to description, is a kind of neutralization of all the, you know, the ad hominem remarks that you might make if you're Lakoff or Jackendoff to everyone else, okay? Or everyone receiving some nasty criticism from Chomsky, for example. Theory to description is a neutralization of the theory. That's a very important part. But when you go and apply the annotation to the data, okay, and you run it, and you get whatever you get, you learn something. And what you learn is then put back into your theory, not to the description, okay? Now, let me just explain this. In models of low-level phenomena, such as part of speech, tagging, and some speech recognition, what you typically get is you start with a theory, you've got the description, but now pretty much you're revising the feature set. You annotate, you run it, you test, so you train and test, which I don't have here, and basically you're looping back here, annotate, feature, add new features, annotate, train, test, blah, 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 blah. Okay, you're looping over here. But we're in an area where you can't do that. Because the changes that we make in the annotation, such that we train and test over them, actually go all the way back to the theory. And that's actually really interesting. Because that's the case, it's my claim that you cannot do linguistic theory without adopting this sort of framework. So this is what I call the model annotate test paradigm. Any questions about this? We'll see this being invoked throughout the series of lectures. For later today, You probably won't see any more reference to this because I'm going to get into some theory. We're not going to have time to get into the annotate and test part. Okay? Are we clear on this? So, language meaning is compositional. Compositionality is a desirable property in a semantic model. Why? Who cares? Why do we need compositionality? Well, most systems that operate over a notion of typing and rules have some sort of logic and a rule base associated with them. If that's the case, then you need the underlying system to be compositional in order for you to be assured of soundness and possibly completeness of your model, but at least consistency. Even if you're doing purely machine learning statistical-based systems, you need some notion of compositional functions. I'm not going to talk about that. Maybe Massimo will talk about that. I'm not sure how technical Massimo is going to get. Now, but it so happens, and I'm sure you're aware of this from just the literature, a lot of linguistic phenomena are non-compositional, and I'm going to talk about those. So if they're non-compositional, then what do you do? Do you add some extra rules? Do you say that something's going on that doesn't appear to be going on, or what? A lot of my work over many years now, last 14, 15 years, has focused on how to create richer modes of composition to enrich the conventional logical compositional operations just enough to make the non-compositional data accounted for. And what I want to talk about today is how that relates to this annotation cycle, but I'm going to talk very, very basically about the notion of selection, which will relate to this morning's lecture. So I'm going to talk about today strong selection, which is the selection of an argument by a predicate through typing. Now, what we're going to see starting Thursday is that all hell breaks loose when you take this lab model and you put it in vivo, you put it into the world. It just doesn't work, okay? It really doesn't work. And that's, of course, the case with any lab model. Montague, Chomsky, Levine, it just doesn't work. You've got to fit it to the data. But the data then tell you how to change it. And that's what we're doing when we do this annotation revise, the model annotate test cycle. So what I want to get to is basically a notion of the principle of decompositionality that will help us do this. So let's begin. The principle of compositionality, everyone here is generally familiar with this? Okay. Stated very simply, it's the meaning of a complex expression is determined by its structure and the meaning of its constituents. This comes to us from Frege, more or less, but it brings up some questions, which are, what's the nature of the structure? So I'm just going to ask, what do you mean by all these different terms you just introduced? What's the nature of the structure? What's the meaning of a constituent? And what counts as a constituent? Okay, so immediately, you might think that part of the constituent structure of an utterance is the intonation. The intonation or the participant, the interlocutor base. So not am I only a speaker, but there are particular hearers. All right? So once you put things into those contexts, you start getting into more complex models, which are very similar to models that have been closer to what structuralists and the Prague School have been working on for quite a while, but also, even kind of in a trivial sense, introducing a notion of context allows you to create a dynamic semantics, such as the dynamic predicate logic and other dynamic logics that have emerged within semantics to take care of discourse. So what counts as a constituent is a really big question. But here are some basic, simple challenges to compositionality. This is within the sentence. This is not a man walked in, he put down his hat. Not the binding of an anaphor to an indefinite noun, which you're familiar with, I'm sure, from discourse semantics. No, these are issues having to do with selection and missing information. And you're probably familiar with elided or ellipsed information. This example, these examples have been floating around for quite a while. I've been talking about these for a long time. I'm going to embed these examples in this discussion. Here's the issue. I have a verb begin, and the verb begin will have to have three subcategorizations. So, if I go to an annotation scheme, such as PropBank, all right, or TimeML, for example, what do I do when I annotate the arguments, the internal arguments to begin? In the one hand, I have a VP, which has an implicit subject, right? A big pro, kind of a controlled VP. Then I have a gerundive in 1B, and I have an event nominal in C. There's a third one, fourth one, which could be the not an event nominal, but to begin a bagel or to begin a coffee. In all of these cases, what is begin selecting? Okay, the very explicit lexicon has to give each one, because each one explicitly. I say, okay, in the one hand, I've got a VP, and it seems to be it's an event. The second case is a gerundive expression, gerundive phrase, and it's an event. The third one is a nominal event, and the fourth one, Mary began her coffee, is a noun entity, and it's interpreted as an event. What they share is an event interpretation. How do I capture that? Do I want to capture that? This is the issue. This is an issue of compositionality. Similarly with enjoy. In enjoy, I'm looking at a different problem. So the enjoys here are the same enjoy or a different enjoy. Well, I'm basically doing something with the beer. Presumably I'm drinking it. Presumably I'm drinking the coffee, and presumably I'm not drinking the movie. I'm watching the movie. I'm getting information from the noun. I'm taking advantage of the context. So here's this notion of context. The context of information that might be associated with something like a movie versus something that might be associated with beer. Okay, so immediately the issue arises. One, how do I actually take advantage of representing such context? Okay, and that's what generative lexicon, GL, has been trying to do for a long time. Feature structures are one way to do that. But then once I've got that information, how do I exploit it? How do I take advantage of it in the operation of the sentence? Okay, so there's kind of two problems. Martha talked about some verbal polysemy cases this morning. Verbal polysemy is a real challenge to compositionality. Why? Because as has been discussed in the literature for quite a while now, going all the way back to an article that Beth Levine wrote with Sue Atkins and Judy Cagle back in 88 or so, namely that to look at a verb such as, for example, bake or broil or roast, these cooking verbs, okay, just very simple mundane verbs in English, they seem to have a change of state interpretation where you just kind of, you're doing something, you're cooking something, and it's going to then become edible. But then the other reading that you get is that you're not cooking a cake to make it edible, you're cooking this stuff to make it a cake. So it's a creation verb. So bake and roast and fry, as in fry eggs versus fry an omelet and so on and so forth, are both change of state and create verbs. Well, how does that happen? Do you store them separately in the lexicon and in your head? Or do you store them next to each other, but they're kind of related? Or is it just one verb that somehow changes magically in the composition, in the context? Okay, there's another area where context comes in handy. And then these cases that have been looked at ever since Fillmore introduced them into the literature but in the mid-60s, these blasted predicates that English has, every language has, which is polyadicity, namely multiple arity, right? Optionality. I can sweep. I can sweep the floor. I can sweep the dirt in the corner. I can sweep the dirt off the sidewalk. I can sweep the floor clean. I can sweep the dirt into a pile. Sweep, in many of these cases, is the same sense. In all of the cases, I'm invoking a core notion of sweep. But in some of these readings, I'm actually doing very different things to the argument, to the internal argument. I sweep a floor in a different way than I sweep the dirt. I'm affecting the final state of the floor. In fact, I'm making it clean. So it's a resultative interpretation. Does this come from a compositional construction, kind of co-composition or construction-based system such as Goldberg's? Or do I have different senses? So this is an issue for compositionality. This is really critical. And so the verbs that enter into those are shovel, rake, shave, weed, and you probably are familiar with these, and you can look and think about what similar verb classes might occur in your language if it's not English. And another major problem for compositionality, and I'll make this very clear, I'll make it formally clear why it's a problem, is that with unaccusatives, I look at the issue of the missing causer. So with break, for example, and sink, and other verbs of change of state that are caused, in the one hand, explicitly, and then the other hand, not explicitly. The vase broke, but Mary broke the vase, and the storm broke the window. And you're familiar with these, of course. The problem from a compositional semantics is, can I have one verb break and then somehow just ignore the causer or the agent or whatever it is on the one hand? Or do I really need two verbs, two lexical semantic representations? Okay. Finally, one major problem to compositionality, as Partee and others noted back in the 70s, is the selective modification of adjectives. The problem here is I have what are kind of slightly intentional interpretations. These guys, former is referring to one aspect of the noun. Escaped is doing something very similar. If you're an escaped prisoner, are you still a prisoner? What's the definition of prisoner? So a prisoner is someone who's being held. But if you're escaped, you're no longer being held. Okay, so you suspend this definition for a while. Escaped seems to be one of those modifiers that allows you to suspend this interpretation. Unbaked cake, that works fine. There's an unbaked cake on the counter. How is it a cake if it hasn't been baked? We understand it's going to be baked later, okay? The intention is for it to be baked. It's no problem. We talk about unbaked bread, unbaked cakes all the time. So we have to be really careful. I might theoretically say, no, unbaked cake is actually inconsistent. That's not even satisfiable in my logical form. But we use it, okay? And if you go to the corpus, you see, in fact, it's very common. So let's not ignore those data, which is what linguists and modelers typically do, right? Like, that's the peripheral data. In fact, that's the central core. That's the core data. So you need to change the theory. Do you change the lexical item, or do you change the mode of composition? You may have to do both. And so on and so forth, okay? I'm not going to go into those data. Okay, so let's look at composition. Most composition is considered to be function application. And you know what function application is, I think, generally. Everyone know what function application is? Yeah? That's a yes, right? So the issue here is, what's the nature of the function? What does it apply to? What can be an argument? Again, these are questions you just don't typically ask. You just want to get on with it, okay? But it's really important, because there's going to be this relationship we see emerging between what we call our arguments, namely agent or human or thing or patient, and what we put what semantic information we put into the predicate itself. There's an inverse correlation between that. So if I take a simple example, John loves Mary. Loves is a two-place predicate, which I've just said is arg1 and arg2. And the basic idea is I've got a VP-centric notion of composition, and I've got arg1 and arg2, and the verb basically applies to this and then applies to that. And then I get my meaning, which I'm building. Okay, so this is a meaning assembly on the basis of lexical items bottom up. Even if you do it top down, it still has to basically mirror compositionality. You could do it left right, a la combinatorial grammar. It still has to mirror compositionality. So this is the simplest form. So basically what I did down there is I apply the predicate to Mary and I get loving Mary, right? Then I apply that predicate, loving Mary, to John, and I get love John of Mary. Now, I can be a little more specific about what I'm doing, and I can say, okay, let's take a simply typed lambda calculus and say that John and Mary are entity types, E, and I'm building a sentence, and sentences are propositions, and propositions I'm going to call type T. They're a Boolean, 0 or 1. And then I'm going to say, this is the real clincher, which is really really critical for all compositional semantics. I can take these guys, these two basic types, and the predicate I'm going to build is built on top of these guys. And that's called functional typing, right? You know that. But we know it, but we ignore it. We ignore what an important generalization this is. So my verb is take an entity and make a T, right? So that's intransitive verb. And you guys know this if you've taken any type of formal semantics. So the simple type tree here is this is like John left. So John is this little E, left is an intransitive verb, a verb phrase, or somebody looking for one argument. And then I do function application, and I say, apply this guy to him, and you get T. Okay, we're all familiar with this? Clear? Now, this rule right here is critical. That's the rule of functional typing. And if we take that seriously, then there are some real problems with current lexical semantic theories as they project to full-fledged compositional semantic theories. And that's what I want to look at. Okay, so if we're clear with this, by the way, I'll make my slides available on the web tonight if you want, assuming you can get them. So compositionality in practice is probably too small. I was trying to make it bigger, I couldn't. John loves Mary, just what I have over there. But formally, with a lambda expression, is just that. It's no different. Okay? Now, so let's get to the meat of things. Selection, it is really critical because when I have a functional type, okay, I'm assuming some notion of base types. I'm assuming E and T. That doesn't give me a lot to work with in terms of how I'm going to differentiate the guys that I would like to distinguish in terms of my the types of verbs that exist in the language. So if all intransitive verbs are E arrow T, then where do I get those distinctions that depend, that create different syntactic realizations and certainly the different semantics? Well, conventionally, as you know, that information, so if I have all intransitive verbs are just ET, then in model theory and in formal semantics, you don't put that information in the lexicon. That's not part of its type. That's part of some additional information that you use in order to compute the sentence meaning, and that's usually done by the lambda expression and then meaning postulates. Okay? Now, this is really critical to understand this, because this is why, in general, with a major exception of Dowdy, and Dowdy's work since mid-70s, formal semanticists have not been interested in the lexicon for that very reason. What's there? There's nothing there. There's just one type. It's E or it's ET. or it's EET. You know, you got an entity, an intransitive verb, or a transitive verb. What more is there to say? Okay? The semanticist is interested in how the type impacts the inference and the way you're going to build the meaning compositionally. Okay? That's the proof. Well, if you're really kind of interested in how concepts relate to the construction of logical form, then maybe you want to question that's all the types that exist. Maybe you want to think that compositional, the construction of the meaning using such types and such rules should maybe take advantage of a richer type system. So that leads us to the issue of what elements can select, what is an argument, how am I going to do that, right? What does it mean to select? And then how does composition and decomposition actually relate to each other? All right. In the predicative complex, the verb, or an adjective, or a noun used predicatively, as in Massimo is a professor, okay? You have a lot of things that you want to characterize as properties, and they're just part of the big predicate, right? They're just a big feature set. And typically, we don't spell all these out unless you're a lexical semanticist. If you're, say, Fillmore or Jackendoff, you're really interested in how predicates differ. So what's in that predicative complex? Well, participant properties, such as someone being human, something being abstract, so think about, something being intentional. The change might be distinguished by location or time or place, etc. And these, of course, are critical in the typology of lexical items, and then hence, through their construction, the typology of languages. So Talmy's work, but in particular, from a theoretical perspective, role and reference grammar has taken the logical form of the lexical item and the syntactic realizations of those into typological distinctions between languages. So RRG is critically tied in to, invested, I should say, with figuring out what the predicative complex has and how you project it. Temporal and locational constraints, intentionality, so kill versus murder, et cetera. Instrumental and cogentive information, the little sister going through the window, being an instrument or not an instrument, of Martha's example from this morning. Psychological states of the participants, such as frighten and fear, and et cetera. Okay. Well, listen. All this stuff, do we put it into the argument position, or do we just call it E? I mean, I can just call it X, where X is typed as E, usually. All right? Or I can call it agent, where agent is a E that's sort of agentive. Okay, I'm kind of begging the question as to what the typing there is. But here I want to stop begging the question and get serious. Which of these aspects of meaning can be abstracted into the arguments of the predicate? So, start simple. We've got a verb, it's got arguments, right? I'm not saying that they're E, I'm not saying that they're T, they're just arguments. Now, if this... So how do you decompose the meaning? If I've got a verb of thought, okay, so I have a belief, and the object of a belief, verb, is a belief. It's going to be propositional. It's going to be some sort of intentional object. So why, if I've got that as a two-place predicate, why is typed as T in that case, isn't it? So they're going to be differentially typed. That could be love. It could be kill, wash. But depending on how I type these, that is, assign a semantic role label, trivially, E and T gives me a predicate, which is take a T to make a normal intransitive verb. So that's the type of believe in Montague grammar. Okay, so it's a transitive verb over beliefs, over propositions. Well, what I want to do is to look at this formally so that we can relate what's been done in formal semantics with what's being done informally from a computational, compositional perspective in annotation science, but formally from the annotation, annotate, train, and test model. Okay? I want to know, how good How appropriate is the semantic role labeling coming that we get from FrameNet or from PropBank? It works to a certain extent over the annotate train test model. How closely can we map that to a compositional semantics? I'd really like to know that. But we have to have some way of actually figuring out how to do that. And if we can do that or work towards that, then we have these amazing resources that are not only resources of the data that are annotated for purposes of everything I mentioned before, but we also can be assured that there's a compositional semantics associated with them. And that's important, because then we can take it and we know what we can do with it, because we know the properties of compositional systems. So let's make a distinction between the body of a predicate and the environment, the argument list, and I'm going to distinguish a number of decomposition strategies, okay? So using a very simple template, what I'd like to do is to look at the trade-off between two things. What's inside the body, and what do we say about the arguments that are binding into the body, all right? I'm going to use programming language metaphors occasionally, but you don't need to know anything about that. Okay, so the trade-off is this. I'm going to go explore theories of decomposition, including my own, but Jackendoff, Levine, Fillmore, etc., by looking at the trade-off between arguments and what we put in the predicate. Okay? The basic model, this is the null hypothesis, I'm going to call atomic predication. And you could also call this the Fodor model. And this basically says, you don't do anything. Okay? It's basically, you got something in syntax. Remember all the different examples for sweep that I had? You sweep the floor, you sweep the dirt into the corner, you sweep the dirt off the floor, you sweep the floor of dirt, yada, yada, yada. Those are all different lexical items. And how do you relate them? Just write some axioms. You write some axioms which are going to be meaning postulates, and it'll work. And it does. The most trivial extension to the null hypothesis, the atomic predication, is what I call parametric decomposition. Parametric decomposition is basically, you don't do anything to what you've got inside your predicate, you just add some arguments to it, okay? Anybody who's done Prolog knows that this is kind of how you define predicates in Prolog. You just add a bunch of arguments. I'll have examples of all these. The simplest way of doing decomposition of the inside, predicative decomposition, I'm going to call simple predicative decomposition. And that's the Katz and Fodor model, where you take something, you break it into separate properties or features. And I'll explain that too. I'm just giving the kind of list. Full predicative decomposition is what you get with Jackendoff's model, with generative lexicon, to a certain extent, with Levine and Rappaport's model, and I'll explain that as well. I should mention, for those of you who may be familiar with, say, Angelika Kotzer's work, and work that's building on that, there's another way of doing this, which is called which I call super lexical decomposition, where meaning can be added through little elements called voice and other non-existent, null categories in the sentence. And I'm not going to talk about that, but I just, for completeness, I need to mention that. All right, so let's go back and mention what is going on with atomic predication. Any questions, by the way, clarification or otherwise? Okay. So in atomic predication, this is basically what I've been assuming with Montague, what early Chomsky assumes, but not doubting, okay? Where basically you got a verb, the way it's expressed in syntax is a reflection of how many arguments it's got in the lexicon, right? So you got three noun phrases, you got three arguments in your semantics. You got five, then you got five, and so on and so forth. You got none, such as in zero place cases, you have none in the semantics. Then you have a syntactic rule that says, there must be subjects in English. So you get a pleonastic it, like it rained and it snowed, okay? So that's pretty straightforward, and this is what we get. So number of arguments equals the number, is a reflection of how many parameters there were in the semantics. Parametric decomposition It can be seen quite trivially as exemplified by two models. The best, most familiar to linguists would be Davidson's event argument, adding the event argument to a predicate. Obviously, there's a lot more going on in the semantics, but from my perspective on decomposition, all that's happening here is you're adding a parameter to the parameter list, and you're not really saying anything internal. Now, what if you're familiar with event semantics, then you might be familiar with Terry Parsons' work that takes Davidson's n-arity model and breaks it into something that's very similar to RDF, if you know RDF. Basically, you've got you have sets of relations, right? That's where the relations model of events comes in. So you've got the John is the agent of the event, Mary is the patient of the event, and so on and so forth. You get this big conjunction, and that's what Parsons does. So that's a very different model than Davidson. The other place you see this parametric, as I mentioned, Prolog, but also a lot in AI, Jerry Hobbs's work. You may be familiar with Hobbs and other people who do work in description logic. For example, you just add a bunch of things that don't necessarily get expressed into the syntax. So for example, I've got go underlyingly, okay, always, okay? Think about this. This is really important. The lexical entry for go in, let's say, Tacitus, and that's Hobbes' abductive system, has got four arguments: an event, the person going, where they're going to, and where they came from. Sorry, let's try to think. What's the other one? Where they went from and to. Okay, so if you don't express it, first off, the basis there is that you don't have to express anything, let's say, except the person moving. Okay, so in fact, you're implicitly assuming some sort of Jackendoff express the theme rule, okay? But you don't need to have necessarily the source, and you don't even need the target, the goal, okay? According to Hobbes. I mean, Hobbes isn't really interested in that. Hobbes wants to do inference, okay? So he can scolemize those guys and just make existential quantifiers for them. He doesn't really care. That's parametric. Simple predicated decomposition is what you're familiar with from Katz and Fodor, and from all the work that comes quite, if it comes really straightforwardly from the structuralist school, structuralist notions of features and matrices with different values of predicates, then you're going to get something like the simple predicated decomposition. All right? So die is this thing, or bachelor is this individual who is characterized by the conjunction of those properties. Okay? Full predicative decomposition takes the parametric and the simple decomposition, predicate decomposition, puts them together, and you get a more sophisticated, you get a richer model. And that's what Generative Lexicon, Jackendoff, and let's say Levine and Rappaport have. As the lexical feature structure associated with a word. Okay? So far? And I'm not going to talk about the way Angelica would do it. So, now let's get to the actual thing. I hope I'm not going too slow. But it's really important for us to get the basis here. All right, so the parameters you give to a relation are actually values of the tuple that satisfy the conditions under which that relation is actually judged to be true in your model, or true in your database if you're doing a computational system. But they're also determinants on the members of the tuple. So, for example, you take a rock fell and a rock died. All right, we know rocks don't die. But it will be the case within conventional model that a rock died will be false. It'll be false because it's not going to be satisfied in the model. Now, the rock fall will be true or false, depending on whether the situation actually is satisfied by the model. Now that leads to some kind of interesting question, which is brought more clearly to light with this example. Imagine the computation that's involved in the subjects of these three sentences. So the woman slept soundly, the soldier died in the street, the child dreamt of Christmas. Okay, in all these cases, I have intentionally chosen human, animate, definite NPs. And what I need to do in computing, in actually computing the meaning for each one of these sentences, I have to essentially see if the conditions on being able to sleep are satisfied by the argument. Okay? So if I'm just saying, okay, you have to be an entity, then entity is going to be associated with the woman. And then basically I have to go and check in my model if this is an entity predicated of woman, by woman, and so on and so forth, and if that's going to be consistent with sleeping. Okay? And there's going to be rules in the model that will allow you to do that. So the computation is inside the computation of the predicate in the model, and likewise for all of the two other examples. But what is striking about these examples, if you're familiar with dynamic programming or chart parsing, is that the computation, if you've done the computation for the woman, okay, that is, computing that the it's a woman, so you have a gender, you have animacy, you have human qualities, etc., and likewise for the other two, soldier and child, respectively, then the packaging or the saving of that information is something that you might like to cache. That's what you do in a chart. You're caching information that you've computed. Okay? Why go do it again? If you've cached it, then let's make a notion that allows you to cache that. What's that called? Well, that's an arc. Let's give the arc a name. We'll call it an NP. So the syntactic representation already has a representation for how to cache that information. The computation has been saved if you've done it. But the semantics has not. Oh yeah, maybe you've bound the variables, but in terms of actually satisfying the conditions under which the predicate will be satisfied, you haven't done that. Well, that's what types do. Types can be seen as a pretest for whether or not the program or the predicate is actually going to be happy with you. So if the conditions are not satisfied, forget it. Don't interpret me. Okay? Let me show you. So argument typing can be seen as abstracting away from the predicate. Richer typing for arguments. So I'm identifying specific predicates from the body, the predicate, of the expression that are characteristic functions of an argument. They're characteristic functions. All right? I'm going to pull that subset of predicates out of the body, and then I'm going to create those as pretests. And they're going to be essentially restricted quantification over a domain of sorts denoted by those predicates. I'm going to try to untangle me and get this out. Take my jacket off. Excuse me. Okay, so far, any questions? So, and I'm going to relate this to the assumptions that Martha was making in her lecture. So what we get is that argument typing is actually abstracting away from the predicate. So here's my predicate, okay? I'm saying you're a transitive relationship. Okay, you're a transitive verb. So you've got two arguments, x1 and x2, right? And I don't really know anything about you except that you're an entity. But the predicate knows all about you. It knows that you got to be human, that you're going to die, because this is the verb kill, and that X1 is got to be an event or human, and maybe intentional, maybe this is murder, okay? Now, but little X1 and X2 don't know anything about that, okay? And they're going to be surprised once they get bound to those variables, to those predicates. Now, what we do when we create types is we take those conditions out of the predicate, and you pull them up front, and you say, look, you're a human, or you're an event, or you're a proposition, or you're an instrument. And they've become reified as types in the binding, in the environment, in the binding structure. if they've become part of the typing structure up here, I don't need them over here. And that's, of course, the whole goal of functional typing. That's why I said, remember the critical aspect of functional typing. Functional typing is so powerful in semantics because the type of the function is entirely determined by its argument. All right? Now, in linguistics, Emmon Bach was the first person to make this distinction, to make this generalization. Montague basically was saying this all along, but nobody really understood him. And then Bach kind of made it clear to linguists, saying, look, wait a second. If we've got Montague typing, that is the type for the predicate. That actually gives us a typology for verbs. So, wow. Okay, but of course you don't get very far because the Montague typing system is not as rich as we might like from lexical semantics or from typology. But the functional typing principle is extremely powerful, but we don't take advantage of it. When we do annotation, when we do lexical semantics, we don't take advantage of it. So, any questions so far? This is critical, and this is going to be, this examples of this are going to be human, patient, or human, instrument, and those types of things. And then the issue arises. Well, what's the list of semantic roles? And then you're back to Martha's problem. The problem that Martha is teaching about. What roles do we take? It's not clear. Are they going to be, do you want to take a minimal set of roles, like Jerry Hobbs would assume? Take the roles 1, 2, and 3. That's what Hobbes suggests. Don't even give them names, just give them positions. Or do you invest them with something that really is a set of predicates from here? That's what Fillmore has been doing for 42 years, and Jackendoff for like 10 years less. So that's what people do, but let's see what the consequences of that are. All right, so to move on. Reifying types really does have an impact, and we take advantage of this. And we have taken advantage of this in semantics, but not with the kinds of types that we're talking about with semantic role labels, except for like proto-role and stuff like that. But even those, for Dowdy, those aren't really types of the verbs. If you look at Dowdy and Ladislaw's work, essentially you're kind of clustering properties of individuals, and you're saying, let's have a convenient notation for this and call them a proto-agent or a proto-theme. But they're not really being used as typing the predicates, all right? Whereas count mass distinctions really are, that's all you need to be blinded by my, really are distinctions that are made lexically, okay? Not much is lexically typed to take mass material, and similarly quantifiers. But the arity, you gotta figure out arity, that's something that's really there, but the nature of what is in the arity is not there. Animacy has to be accounted for. The man versus the rock fell is okay, but not the die, the example I gave you. So animacy is something that should be represented. As a type, though, sure, because that's the way people are typing it in the semantic annotation frameworks. Let's see if, in fact, it works out to be a compositionally sound way to do it. This is the whole interaction we're having, and so on and so forth. You know these data. Okay, one thing that's kind of interesting is that look at the professor counted his students. He had 10 graduates and 5 undergraduates, or he had only one. Okay, so you ask yourself, what is the verb count in English selecting? Is it selecting for plural or a notion of number? Well, we know it has to be number because one is a satisfiable acceptance. So otherwise you have to violate the condition, the constraint that you had of counting a plural, okay? So you can count your class. Count your class? You can't count your class, but you can count your students. Okay, here's the issue, right? This is plural, right? That's a plural satisfaction of that. This is a single satisfaction of this. So count has to be something that involves number and not plural. The number may be plural. Okay, so now GL is intentionally quite unabashedly, a type decomposition formalism. Perhaps a little too unabashedly, because in a way, it's so rich in its expressive capacity that you don't really know when to use something versus when to use something else. And so, for example, if you were to go annotate corpora, text, with a lot of the GL mechanisms, well, first off, where would you begin? And what elements of the theory would you actually invoke? And how would you know when to use one versus the other? What you start seeing, really quite interestingly, is redundancy. There's a lot of redundancy in the theory. Just as what we've seen with the merging of syntactic theories, we see a lot of redundancy in syntactic description, in the theories within syntax. The redundancy within the framework, for example, which I think is really quite interesting. So let me go with my starting points. Just kind of bread and butter for what I'm, the way I view language. Language is going to be just a reflection of our general categorization abilities and the way we think. So compositionality is not a property of language. It's a property of the way we put thoughts together. So it's the way we reason. Language happens to be the vehicle, that one vehicle which actually displays those thought processes. And so if that's the case, then I really think that we should have a compositional system. Now, what I've been interested in really for the last 5 years or so is actually taking such a system and accounting for the real data. This has been by working with corpus linguists, lexicographers such as Patrick Hanks, and just looking more and more at real data from doing applications. Coming to this realization that I was going on about for probably too long at the beginning of the lecture about the lab model needing to go to in vivo in order to be tested. Okay, so I see this as kind of merging two traditions, corpus language philosophy and general lexical research. All right, now in GL, I'm going to pitch GL and I'm going to try to show you what notion of selection is inherent in GL. There are two kinds of constraints on a concept, in other words, the binding: arguments and events. Now, events are arguments, but events can be normal arguments, but the internal event structure of kind of the trace of the proposition, the change of state or whatever, is done by the event structure. These bind into a qualia structure. How many people are familiar with GL? A couple? I'll go into some detail. And then the point here is that in order to account for some of these mismatches and the problems in compositionality, we're going to enrich our notion of compositionality by exploiting, by using some operations that I'm going to call coercion. So there's going to be three ways for things to get together. Unlike just function application, where basically you match or you don't, there's going to be three ways to get together in the system. You can select, which is function application. You can accommodate, which is you inherit that information from somebody. Or you coerce. So there's going to be, selection is kind of like basic application. So you either apply, accommodate, or coerce. Now, using the strategy that I was talking about earlier, this kind of models to this. I've got my body of qualia and constraints, and then my environment. And that's how I'm going to build a lexical item. And what I want to do is to show how you want to do this really, really conservatively. Because I want to understand, when I reify some properties to make them a type, I want to understand that that was the right thing to do. Because I've got to have a type system, and someone's going to have to go annotate this. And there are semantic consequences for this, as well as syntactic consequences. Now, the qualia structure is the body of the sort of basic component of the predicative complex that I was mentioning before. And this is something that holds cross-categorially. And there are four qualia. Each qualia, essentially inspired by Aristotle's notions of cause, which are really explanations of our concepts. You have the basic category, which is, let's say, it's is a relationship. You have what's called constitutive, what it might be composed of, if there is anything it's composed of. You have a purpose, if in fact there is a purpose. It's telos or telic. And then something that might characterize how it came about. Now, a concept does not need all these four. These are like little case roles or thematic roles or something. But I'm simplifying matters to say that at most, a concept and the lexical realization for that will have no more than these four. And typically, this is done in a big feature structure that I'm not going to go into. So in this sense, compositionality is capturing how the verb, let's just say, attaches and takes in all its arguments. And it's, so compositional rules refer to types, okay? That's a given from our functional typing. Types can be selected, they can be accommodated, or they can be exploited or introduced. And I'm going to go into the details of those, probably more Thursday. Then you can create new interpretations by co-composing things. What I'm going to take advantage of is a very simple layering of the types in the language. Just like you have mass and count, I'm going to say that you have natural kinds and then artifactual kinds. Then you've got this other mechanism which allows us to put contradictory things together, which I call complex kinds, complex types. All right? So the basic distinction, though, is natural versus non-natural, and I'll explain why. These are seen, this will be the basic lexical typing throughout the language. In fact, we have an implementation of this for several languages. The largest one is Italian and English, the simple lexicon that Calzolari built, and the BSO that we built in Brandeis. Okay. Here's the idea. Natural kinds are those things that you would experience to be natural kinds. Artifactual kinds, or here I've got it as F, it should be an A, are things that you might think of as actual artifacts or things that have purposes. And then complex kinds I'm going to get to in a second. But here's the rub. Because of the functional typing principle, I don't need to do anything else for talking about verbs. If I type rock as a natural, then I can come up with a natural predicate, because a natural predicate will take rock and make it an intransitive. So I have intransitive verbs that take naturals. I might have intransitive verbs that take rocks. So the idea, unlike in philosophy, like Putnam and Quine, or in psychology even, natural kinds does not exist for just entities, but exists for predicates, for adjectives, and for propositions. You have natural predicates. Falling, walking, rain, put, have, these are natural predicates. Similarly, you have inherently artifactual predicates, such as donate, spoil, quench. So the difference between give and donate is give is a natural predicate, and donate is an artifactual predicate. There may be others, but that's one. Adjectives differ too. Red, large, flat are natural properties. Useful, good, effective refer to a purpose. Okay, that's what they're typed as. And something like rising, like in a rising temperature, that's actually a complex predicate, and I'll explain how. So, we have about 5 minutes so that we have time to get to lunch by one. It's about 10 till. Let me now go a little bit into the motivation for this and then what the mechanisms really are. So I said that there's pure selection, which is the type is getting what it is asking for. Okay? That's like conventional Montague. So a function comes along and says, I want an A. And the guy's an A. He says, okay, here you go. Then you got accommodation. The type a function requires can be inherited. So I'll show you how that works. But then you got coercion. In fact, most of the world of our language takes place in accommodation and coercion. But this is a good base case from which I know what kind of changes to make. So this is like the base case, and I'm going to see how rich I need to make accommodation and coercion. I don't know why that guy's there. Okay, so let's motivate natural kind. I don't need to do it philosophically. We understand natural kind philosophically. What about linguistically? Because that's what I'm interested in. Do we really have a reason to say that a natural kind behaves linguistically differently than a non-natural kind? It doesn't seem to be the case. I have an artifactual or kind of a functional term such as pet. And, you know, I can see pets, I can see dogs, I can visit a natural man, or I can visit an artifactual doctor. Okay? I'm taking agentive nominals of occupation to be artifactual. A plane is an artifact. Birds and planes both fly in English. So what's the difference? What's the difference, right? Well, I'm going to say that there are actually three contexts that are quite distinguishable. And these are going to be our criteria, the diagnostics, as a linguist would say. Nominal predication, how the noun can behave predicatively. Adjectival predication, how adjectives modifying the noun can be interpreted. And interpretation in coercive contexts, how the noun, the NP with the common noun, can be interpreted when being coerced. Well, what do I mean? So as I said, it looks pretty straightforward. You know, sick dog, American man, doctor, white birds, planes. Okay, that doesn't seem to be a distinction. But once we get to here, basic predication, the classification of an individual as having some sortal, then we start seeing some differences. So these are that's my dog and that's my cat. They really are. And Otis is a dog and he's a poodle. But I can't say Otis is a dog and an animal. Forget the one and. By virtue of a dog, you are an animal. So I can't, in other words, I can't take two natural kind predications over the same individual. That's a dog and a cat, meaning the same thing. I can say that's a dog and that's a cat, but not that's a dog and a cat. Otis is a dog and therefore an animal, so therefore construction actually points to an inherited property, right? Dogs are animals. Okay, that's interesting. This box is large and small, so this kind of sounds similar to predication of adjectives that you've probably seen from psychology. This box is large and small. You can't say your gift is round and square. You can't do that because they seem to be contradictory, unless you're somehow referring to different aspects of the object. So there's something similar to that. But notice when you get to artifacts, you can talk about this being a pen and a pointer, right? Or a pen and a knife. So substance is a stimulant and an anti-inflammatory. I'm talking about different functions. When I talk about functions, they can be orthogonal. But when I talk about natural predication, I have a tree. I really have a tree. And you have to not violate that tree. So similarly, I can characterize an individual as having two roles, similarly. And as having two roles, you get two modes of inheritance. So Emmanuel acts as a pianist and therefore a musician. Emmanuel acts as a pianist and therefore a human. So pianists are humans, but not directly, only by virtue of being a musician. So I can inherit the musician aspect of pianist, or the human aspect of pianist through musician, okay? So it's kind of like two ways of inheriting, but that's only available to artifacts. Similarly, when I talk about predication of things like young and new and old and beautiful, of artifact, of naturals, there's only one meaning. A beautiful flower. Yeah, maybe it's beautiful in many different ways, but a beautiful flower is a beautiful flower. Young tiger is a young tiger. Okay, unless contextually, say, you bring in a new tiger to the zoo, and that's our young tiger. You wouldn't say young tiger; you'd say new tiger. But with artifacts, you get two interpretations. You get an interpretation of the natural aspect and the artifactual aspect. So what I'm trying to point out is that I've built additional information into an artifact. It's more informative, and because it's more informative, there's more locations to modify. That looks like a syntactic tree, doesn't it? Rather than having just one thing, I actually have two points of modification. A beautiful dancer
can point to the individual or the dancing. It's a classic example. But this is also a classically good example for there being lexical decomposition. Similarly for good professor and a very old friend. Okay, finally, and I'll just close on the motivation from coercion for naturals. Artifactuals, non-naturals, carry their own context with them because that's what they're defined to be. I know what beer is. I can either enjoy drinking it or not enjoy drinking beer. And I know what a thesis is. I know that if I'm the person writing a thesis, that beginning a thesis is the writing. As an advisor, I'll begin someone's thesis, and that's going to be the reading of it or the reviewing of it. So I'm carrying the context as the object, but also as the individual who's starting the aspectual process. You don't get that with naturals. You can finish a tree if you're doing something to the tree, pruning it, or fixing the tree for Christmas, for example. Beginning a tiger, again, if it's a toy tiger or you're drawing a picture of a tiger in watercolor, Mary or Sophia finished her tiger. Those contexts are contextually coerced contexts. Okay, these are just not acceptable. So there's three grammatical characterizations for the distinctions between naturals and artifactuals. Okay, they have linguistic consequences cross-linguistically, from what I've found so far. Now, let me close there. What we're going to do is that, what have I done? I've motivated, I think, a very, very minor enrichment to the type system. That type enrichment is going to be used for labeling arguments to predicates, very much as we saw in Martha's lecture. And we're going to have to enrich things a little bit more. But once we do that, then we're going to go to the corpus and see whether this labeling actually matches the data. And we're going to find some really interesting surprises. In many cases, it matches directly, but it's very interesting where it doesn't. Where it doesn't is actually where we need to work on theory and enrich the theory or constrain the theory or cut out whole aspects of the theory. And that's the cycle actually in practice. So we'll start there on Thursday. Okay, time to lunch.